Tonight on The Download, political analysts Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy, art gallery owner Monique Maloche, and from Koi Dog Pondering, Frank Oro. And now, here's your host, a man who refuses to use an umbrella, Justin Kottman.
That's what hoods are for. Stop being such a baby and take a little rain off the noggin. That's for you, Pete. That's what hats are for. Umbrellas. Am I the only one who cares about the rule? We don't have umbrellas. All right, forget it. You know what? I had this long rant earlier this week that I don't use an umbrella. And the reason is because, you know what? I think that tells you that, you know what? If you're using an umbrella, you're too worried about the world around you. Me, I like to go, boom, right into it. If it's raining, figure it out. But you know what? Nothing's going to stop me. I'm not taking anything extra with me. What do you think of that, Pete? Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Listen, I know it's crappy outside and you probably have a little bit more time in your car than you had anticipated, but we got a great show for you tonight. Lots of good interviews and discussions, so hopefully we can take your mind off the commute for a couple of minutes. First tonight, we're going to debate the political hot potato. What should our stance on Syrian refugees be? And is our government doing all it can to deal with ISIS and the issues in Syria? Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling return to The Download to argue with each other. And in the 8 o'clock hour, Frank Oral stops by the studio and he's bringing his guitar. Frank, of course, the frontman for Koi Dog Pondering. We're going to talk to him about the 20th anniversary of their hit record, Pomegranate. Plus, we'll talk to him about being a working musician here in Chicago. Also tonight, we're going to talk about the art scene in Chicago. I really am looking forward to this conversation. I don't know a lot about the art scene. We're talking about galleries and fine art. It's something that I've always wanted to know more about, and I think we have the right guest tonight. Monique Maloche is the owner and proprietor of Monique Maloche Gallery on Division Street in Ukrainian Village. We're going to talk to her about her busy winter season, but also about what she's done to make sure Chicago gets the respect it deserves in the art world. Because if you go out to Miami, there's Art Basel. If you do New York, it's all over. New York's a huge place for that. Obviously, overseas, Europe. But with the Chicago Expo and the other things happening here in the art world, Chicago is a big player too. So we'll talk to Monique about that coming up a little bit later. Also, we're going to talk theater. Neil Simon, in particular, his play Chapter 2 on stage at the Windy City Playhouse. What can a 1977 play about relationships do to help us with ours in 2015? We're going to talk with some of the actors of that play coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And we'll talk some sports. Well, the business of sports. Jay Cutler has a big contract. But what do we need to know about it? Because there's so much right now. Obviously, he's having a great season. But before he started actually connecting with his own receivers and was throwing interceptions, we were talking about when's the right time to dump him and get out of that contract. Well, Frank Thurber is going to be here. We're going to talk about his piece he wrote for Forbes about what kind of contract it is. Also talk about some of the other contracts in Chicago sports. Obviously, the Bears have a couple, Matt Forte, Alshon Jeffrey. But what about the contracts of other coaches at the college ranks? Brian Kelly comes to mind. Pat Fitzgerald comes to mind. So we'll talk with Frank about that coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. All that plus news, weather, and traffic updates. Rob Martier and Eric Solomon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download. It's a show about Chicago starring those who live here. All right. Why don't we kick things off with the carryout? Of course, this is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Are we still not letting Syrian refugees into Illinois? I can't tell anymore since I get all my news from social media. It feels like this issue is the defining one of our time. It's not, but really there are less than 100 Syrian refugees in Illinois. Now, it would be something else entirely if we start banning Iraq and Afghanistan refugees, Central American refugees, Asian refugees, Mexican refugees, build a wall, build a border. Oh, God. Oh, sorry. Oh, God. I think I just got a case of the Donald Trumps. Speaking of Donald Trump, he took to Instagram today to ask if President Obama was insane. I don't know, using 15-second Instagram videos to make your point that someone's insane, may actually do the opposite. Fast rants with Donald Trump.
Insane. Bomb them. Vote Trump.
But we do bomb them, right? I mean, like over 6,000 times in the last 3 years.
We'll bomb more. Well,
everyone realized that the bombing campaigns and the war in Syria are the reason there are refugees, right? Am I the only one completing that circle? All right, just making sure we're all on the same page. Illinois State Senator Napoleon Harris is throwing his hat in the ring for U.S. Senate. The former NFL linebacker-turned-politician is running as a Democrat. At his presser today, he was asked about Governor Rauner's stance on banning Syrian refugees. His answer, yeah, he hadn't heard about that, which I guess is the new no comment. I expect my candidates to listen to the download. Jeez, even we talked about that yesterday. Maybe if he was a subscriber to my new social platform, you know what I heard? Then he'd be up to speed. I mean, seriously, forget Facebook and Twitter. Instagram, yesterday's news. The new platform, you know what I heard? Is meant for the latest in mistruths, rumors, gossip, and all the other stuff that we love about the internet and we hate about news, links, and journalism. Just, you know what I heard? Anyway, I think Harris should sign up. He'd love it. A petition is being circulated on Michigan Avenue to rid the area of the Bucket Boys. Yeah, these are the kids. Well, let's face it, adults, that play buckets like drums on Michigan Avenue for cash. Businesses and residents say the drumming hurts the bottom line. What? How does this hurt the bottom line? Like 10, 15 drums doing this at the same time, cascading off the Michigan Avenue buildings for 45 minutes. Ah, come on. How is that annoying? So far, the only people to sign the petition are the Greenpeace volunteers and the guy painted all silver. When asked for comment, the man painted all silver said, "I can't talk because I painted my mouth shut." A medical marijuana shop in Andersonville opened its doors yesterday, but they forgot one thing, the marijuana. When reached for comment, the owner said, "Wait, who is this man? We're already out of weed? That's a bummer." Plans are in the works to have a new ice rink in Wicker Park. So typical. Yuppies ruining my Wicker Park. What's next, a luxury hotel and a Chipotle? Don't you dare bring American Apparel in here. No word on whether or not the ice rink will let that one homeless guy with the dreads and his dog sleep on it, because they sleep on everything. Uber is offering one-day on-demand flu shots. The only problem is the GPS is all messed up, so they can't figure out where to prick you with the needle. The shoulder? I don't know, the knee? The buttocks? Sorry, it's my first day. It's my first day giving flu shots. In weather, it's crappy out, man. It is so crappy. In sports, yesterday it was Chris Bryant's day. Today, Joe Madden. Madden named Manager of the Year, mostly because of his PJ Pajama Jam. And maybe since he bought reporters beers. Remember that on the first day? That probably seals the deal for manager of the year. But also maybe because the Cubs were really bad last year and this year they're really good. Yeah, maybe. Could be. The UC is popping tonight, but not with NHL or NBA action. College basketball. Duke plays Kentucky and Kansas plays Michigan State in a doubleheader. Expect a lot of backwards hats on Madison Street tonight. The Bears are 4-5, but since the playoff picture is wide open, it makes him a contender. So what does that mean for the first-year regime when it comes to rookie wide receiver Kevin White? Well, the Bears have till next Tuesday to decide to activate him for the remainder of the season or shut him down. Me? I say play him. But what do I know? I'm just a fan. Wait, can they redshirt him? Is that a thing in the NFL? Can you redshirt him? Oh, you can't? Yeah, play him. And finally, in this week's Health and Science News, coffee drinkers may live longer. In next week's Health and Science News, coffee. Is it killing you? Yes. Well, that's the carryout for November 17, 2015. Hey, we're having a half-off sale on Tiger Blood. Get it while it's hot. And you thought I wasn't going to talk about Charlie Sheen. So many voices. I'm like a one-man show. I was the weed dealer. I was Donald Trump. Wicker Park hipster, so many things. Coming up, we're going to debate Syrian refugees. Should we take them or not? It's a download here on WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the heart and humanity that was on display this weekend for victims of terrorist attacks in Paris has been replaced by vigorous political debate over foreign policy and who we let into this country. It's becoming the big ticket item in the 2016 campaign as well. So, you know what? Let's debate. I've heard it both ways, and I've heard it eloquent on both sides, and I know the two gentlemen who are sitting in front of me both have opinions on the matter. Joining me in studio to talk about this issue and a few others is Democrat political analyst Dave Lundy, Republican analyst Chris Roebling. This is a regular segment on The Download. We like politically speaking, Dave. That's what we kind of came up with.
Yeah, it's, you know,
that's, I mean, it's a little boring.
Yeah.
I mean,
hey,
if any
of your listeners have a better idea, we're open.
312-981-7200. If you text in what you think the name of this segment is, I'll give you a pizza. How about that? I've been dying. The one thing I haven't done well at WGN in the beginning months that I've been here is being able to commandeer the giveaways. There's a big pile of giveaways, and
yeah,
I never get in there.
You got to work on that.
So I have commandeered pizzas. That's like at the so I have Lou Malnati pizza. So if you can name this segment, I personally like Crosswitch or something like that. You know, something like that that we can do. Anyway, let's get right to it. Obviously I was on the air when this happened on Friday night, the attacks in Paris. But right away it came down to, you know, foreign policy. We started talking about this president and what he's done for the war in Syria, if you call it that. We talked that, and then Governor Rauner comes out on Monday about we're not going to take in Syrian refugees. I mean, where do we start, Dave?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to parse those two things out. I mean, there's a question about our humanity as a country, as a people, in terms of how we want to treat these refugees from a horrific situation. You know, the European countries have taken in millions and millions and millions of immigrants, and we're talking about a few thousand that we're talking about in the U.S. And so I think, frankly, the people like Governor Rauner, who today was chastised in an editorial by Crane,
right,
saying, shame on you, Governor, and 29 other Republicans around the country, plus Paul Ryan and the Republicans in Congress, see the political power of this issue. And I think there is potential power, but that doesn't make it right. You know, I was thinking about this in the context as a Jew and as somebody who was a founding member of the Illinois Holocaust Museum. You know, I cannot believe we are here again turning away people who are suffering so much with no consideration for that. And I just think that's not who we are as a country, and we need to make sure they're vetted. So I think there's that versus the foreign policy
Let's start there. When you heard Governor Rauner, Chris, yesterday say, you know what, we're going to temporarily ban Syrian refugees and look at the process, what was your first thought on that?
Good move. Way to go, Governor Rauner. And I don't think it's about politics. I think it's about safety and security. And I think it's about what the credibility we assign to the Obama administration at this point, you know, 6.5 years in, with what we can say, not getting into the foreign policy thing, but sort of a record of failure, mismanagement, obduracy, and as far as I'm concerned, feckless inattentiveness. So I don't think we can.
That's a soundbite, man. That's a good soundbite. I'm pulling that one.
Feckless
out.
Inattentiveness.
We cannot trust. I don't think that any of the states. We've got 52% of the people in the country questioning the efficacy of the so-called screening process. And let me just tell you about the screening process. The screening process relies on pre-existing data, and when we're talking about Syria, there's almost none. So the screening process that you do for Iraqis, for instance, where we had 10, 12 years of presence and 10, 12 years of data and a lot of knowledge and awareness, mm-hmm. That's a very serious vetting process. That's not what we have for Syria. And I'm not alone. This isn't, you know, David wants to hit the partisan button here.
I want to hit the partisan button.
The president's own FBI Director Comey has expressed serious reservations about this. You've got the director of the CIA expressing reservations, expressing concerns. So this is this, and it's not just Republican governors. There is a Democratic governor in there from New Hampshire, I believe. And I think this is really a question of clamping down on the safety and the security, which means clamping down on what David just said.
18 months to 2 years. It's 18 months to 2 years before any refugee who applies now would ever set foot in the United States, because that's how long the process takes to vet these people. Now, Chris is right in one respect. We haven't been in Syria for the last decade. But that's... I think that if Republicans were serious about this, were focused on the security issue, they would have said, look, we're concerned about the security issue and let us all work together to come up with a vetting process to make sure that's right.
That's exactly what Paul Ryan said. No, that's not. That's exactly what Paul Ryan's position is. It is a security issue. And I want to say this.
It's a security issue, but then we'll all shut the doors.
Let's understand. No, that's not true. He did not say that. He said, let's pause it. Let's get this thing worked out and then let's restart.
Until we get past the election.
Because Americans express their generosity, I think, in this way. But having said that, let me give you a counterexample. The Special Immigrant Visa Program, SIV program, which was started by Teddy Kennedy in recognition of the failure of the Bush administration to bring back the folks who had helped us in Iraq, okay, became a campaign issue in that quarter for the Obama campaign. Samantha Power, Barack Obama, two names you've heard since then, promised we'll do better than Bush, we'll do better. We want these people back, we understand. They're completely vetted. Why? Because these are the folks who were vetted over in country, in Iraq, to work with our army or our embassy personnel, what have you, okay? Barack Obama's record on the SIV program has been worse than George Bush's record.
Let me ask you this, though, because what I'm most interested in is about the bigger picture, and you've brought it up a couple times here, Chris, about whether or not the president has done a good job with foreign policy overall. I mean, because this is one of these issues where it keeps getting brought up. A terrorist attack in Paris comes up that the president of the United States is not doing a good job. Dave, do you think that the president is doing a good job when it comes to foreign policy?
Well, here's the thing. I am a big supporter of the president, but I would agree with my friend Chris here that the president has been too slow to recognize the ISIS threat. Chris is going to want to bring up the statement where Barack said ISIS was contained, quote unquote contained. But
or
the fact
JV,
that,
red line.
Okay, the JV, the red line. You're 100% right. The contained thing. That's he said they were contained in Iraq because they're losing territory, not gaining territory, which they are. Nonetheless, that's irrelevant. It's irrelevant to where we are, right. And where we are is in a situation where the entire globe. I mean, there's a reason that these guys are attacking Russia. They're attacking France. If they have their way, they'll attack us. They're trying to create the West versus Islam. That is the goal of how they intend to recruit. I was listening, watching one of their shows, and General Barry McCaffrey was on, and he said the worst thing we could do is to put tens of thousands of Christian or United States or European troops in there to try to take these guys out, because it's what they want us to do. And on this refugee thing, there's a reason that they're saying that that passport of one of the terrorists was a fake. They want us to believe.
Chris, that's a good point, because we've seen that throughout this conflict in Syria, where there seems to be the countries of the West are saying, let's not engage because that's what they want us to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you react to that as sort of foreign policy, where it seems like almost patience or the idea of holding back is the norm?
Yeah, I think that measured responses are always called for in foreign policy, especially when you're moving from foreign policy or diplomacy into a realm in which the use of force and military power is envisaged. So I think what you have here, I don't think that the Europeans or the Americans necessarily, quote, have it wrong about treading lightly in Syria. I think that the center of gravity, say, in the Republican Party right now, which does hold that Barack Obama has a fetishistic fixation on his bizarre.
He's on fire today.
I love it.
It's a fetishistic fixation on his bizarre interpretation of Islam, which we can talk about sometime. But in any case, he is profoundly wrong about Islam and has been since the Cairo speech. In any case, people are not saying, let's send in the 82nd Airborne. Let's send in the 102nd. People are not saying a mechanized division's got to land on the beaches. People are trying to be measured and proportionate and layered and effective. And so far, unfortunately, and I say this as an American, a loyal American, unfortunately, our president has been ineffective.
It's Chris Roebling. It's Dave Lundy. When we come back, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit closer to home, Governor Rauner and the debate, and obviously the no budget and they were going to meet this week, and it got pushed back to December 1st. But let's talk about where we're at with politics down in Springfield, and then get an update on the 2016 election, which is coming up. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio with me.
Hello.
One's a Democrat. Hello. One's a Republican. I had asked for names because we were kind of going politically speaking. My favorite from 815, and I think this is worth a pizza, Pete. Pizza Pete. Touche.
Touche.
I like Touche.
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 Touche, Mr. Fantastic Fetishist of whatever you were saying.
All right, so no budget, November. Who's winning, Republicans or Democrats down in Springfield?
Nobody's winning. The people are losing. This is the most horrible situation in state government. And I say that in a state where we've had Rod Blagojevich and Pat Quinn and George Ryan. So, although, frankly, George Ryan, great governor. Yeah, not so great on the ethics. But this is a horrible situation. The governor refuses to negotiate about the budget. There was a minor breakthrough last week, but even today, that seemed to break down when his head of Health and Human Services said, "Oh, I never really said the child care would go back to 185% of poverty." Blah blah blah. It's a mess. And the thing is, Justin, the Democrats think that they're winning. The Republic, Bruce Rauner thinks that he is absolutely winning, and winning big. He can't believe what a great position they're in right now. They're not both right.
You know what? We needed an adult down there to straighten things out after 12 years of total Democrat dominance, in which time all of these issues intensified and I think worsened, and that's clear to the naked eye.
Including the 26 years of Republican consecutive control.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about 12 years of total Democrat domination immediately preceding. And that's with Blagojevich and Quinn and Cullerton and Madigan. And the fact is, they didn't do a thing. They didn't lift a toothpick to straighten this mess
out.
Not
true.
They didn't lift a toothpick to straighten this mess out. And they're not lifting a toothpick now. And my friend David says, quote, the governor is not negotiating. The governor is actually, in my opinion, this is the only problem. This gets him to A minus from A. He's sort of negotiated a little bit against himself because Madigan, thanks to the largest super PAC in Illinois, the Chicago mainstream, lamestream media.
Are you? Oh, good God.
Basically just gives these guys all the cover. They're under six layers of down quilt. That's how much cover you got.
Chris is working on his Ted Cruz lines today. I'm really impressed with this.
I want to say that Rauner should not negotiate against himself. And he knows that from the business world, but this is his first year in government.
Jim Edgar, his own comptroller, the Crane Chicago Business, and countless editorial boards are saying the governor is holding the budget hostage.
It's not true.
I'm not making this up.
No, but they're saying that because they're part of the super PAC.
I have a key question for you.
Not because it is accurate.
I have a key question. Yes, Jim Edgar is part of the Democratic super PAC. Anyway,
Edgar is wrong on this. That
I have a question. Just a key question for you.
Go ahead.
If Barack Obama had a small super minority of Democratic votes in the House and Senate in Washington, and he had a policy that he was insisting on, and he didn't have the votes for it, and he insisted, no, I'm going to get that policy, and I'm going to hold this government hostage until you pass my policies, even though I don't have votes, what would you guys be saying about that? You'd be calling him a dictator.
You know, we do that all the time.
You're right.
He's been doing that. Now, this isn't a dictator down in Springfield, and I'll tell you why. Madigan and Cullerton, if they want to have a budget, and I said this before, but it's still
they
true.
They don't have a supermajority.
They can pass
Lie.
Anything.
Not true, my friend.
They can pass anything they want. And if they can't pass anything right now, they could announce today that on the 1st of January, here's the budget we're going to pass since we can't get a response from Governor
Rauner. They have 68
that would be the lying
votes in
statement.
The House. They need 71.
Okay.
They do not have a working supermajority. They don't. This is a fantasy. It's a talking point.
If those guys,
and meanwhile, while you guys are having your talking points, the kids are losing their child care. The people are being thrown out of group homes. I mean, we are in a disaster. Social service agencies around this state are being decimated because of these games.
You know what?
And it was a strategy.
He has to stop every once in a while.
Why do you?
No, this is a cage match.
I stop all the time. So
touche.
Cut that out.
You know, you could get that on a little button.
Really,
touche.
Let's wrap it up. You get the last word.
Thank you.
Ouch.
David had not a syllable of concern such as what we just heard 12 short months ago, when in fact social service agency on the board of which Haymarket Center, one of the great addiction treatment and rehab facilities in the world, has been bled to more than $6 million by the profligate spending and policies of the Democrats. And David didn't care, and none of the Democrats cared. This is entirely political because of their determination that they can take this to the governor. My opinion is the governor is winning, the governor will win, and ultimately the taxpayers and the people of Illinois will win because we need reform now, and the only guy bringing it is Bruce Rauner. And that's the last word.
Touche! Touche!
Thank you.
Yes, Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. I wish you guys were here every night. I sit back. I just enjoy it. I also think a good name would be Lamestream.
Lamestream.
That could be good, too.
What? You're going to give me a Sarah Palin name I got to live with? No, I'd rather have Touche, man. Keep working on it.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Justin.
Little Poor Dog Pondering here on the download on WGN. My guest tonight at the big table is a man who's dedicated his life to music, Frank Orrell. Been a part of the Chicago rock music scene for decades, working and collaborating with several musicians on countless projects. But his main squeeze, he's a frontman for Poi Dog Pondering. Poi Dog has seen several lineups over the years, several albums, including Wishing Like a Mountain, Thinking Like the Sea, Volo Volo, and Pomegranate, which is a 20-year anniversary. This year, just played a show at the Vic. But more than the music, Poi Dog's become an institution in Chicago. Tonight, we talk about the band's ascension from performing on the streets to major labor challenges to the 20th anniversary of Pomegranate and their new work, their new record, which is out now, Everybody's Got a Star. It is my pleasure to welcome Frank Orrell to the download. Frank, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you. Thanks, Justin. I appreciate you having me.
It's amazing. I'm giddy to the point where I feel like all afternoon I've been jamming Poi Dog Pondering. Like it's great to think about that. So, you know, it's funny because I was looking at your Facebook group page and you had a really great line that was like from, you know, street busking to the challenges of a major label, like what to do with this band. We've seen it all. Talk about how Poi Dog Pondering came about.
Yeah, Poi Dog. You know, I 30 years ago, I started making cassette albums at home. Like, I started out with like two beat boxes. You know, I would record like the guitar on one beat box, and I would play that one, and then I would record on the other one, and I would put my vocals on it, and I would go back and forth like that. And then moved on to, you know, like, and that was just making songs, you know, and then made about three cassette albums and formed a band around it in Hawaii. And we started there and we just used to play on the street, you know, as street musicians for about a year.
Really?
Traveled across the mainland as street musicians.
And how many people were in the band at that point?
There were 5 to 8. Yeah. 5 to 9, actually.
That's a big band to be playing on the street.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, and it was great because, you know, I mean, if you go and you play in the street and you're just by yourself, people are a little afraid of you. But if you have 5 people, they get curious.
Well, they like
it,
hey,
yeah. What's going on here, you know?
You're absolutely right. Michigan Avenue, if there's 5 or 6 people on Michigan Avenue playing in a band, you're like, oh, I got to stop and check this out.
Yeah. And we had a nice adventure, you know, and then we spent a year doing that, and we settled in Austin, Texas, and we got a record deal while we were playing on the street, which is crazy, but that's how we got a record deal. Then we went to Austin and recorded the first 3 records there and enjoyed it, lived there. And
you came to Chicago in the early 90s, right?
Yep.
That's when you came here. And at that time, Chicago had a lot going on music-wise. I mean, that was the explosion of the rock scene here,
yep.
Which became
it was exciting.
We've had so many bands in here talking about that history from you know, Urge Overkill to Veruca Salt. But Poi Dog was a big part of that because when you came here, I don't know if it was the support of the radio, WXRT, but you guys really became a darling here in Chicago pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, we had been touring through here when we were living in Austin still yet. And that's how we got to know the city and got to like it. And we were, you know, fortunate enough to like open for like Robin Hitchcock and Throwing Muses and stuff like that. So we were able to get play in front of people right away, you know, and Sue and Julia over at Lounge Acts were always quick to give us a gig, you know? And so like when we got to town, we had a good head start, which is nice. Yeah.
I mean, for you, looking back to those days when you came here, what was the goal of coming to Chicago? Was it to try and get be ambitious and get a major record deal? Was it to ride the sort of wave that was happening here in rock music?
No, I mean, I didn't know about all that stuff till I moved here. About Smashing Pumpkins or any of those bands, I didn't know about it. You know, oddly, when you're in a band, you kind of get so monofocused. You know, you're especially. At the level we were, at that point, we were a major label band, so we were just like, we were working on the next record all the time. I wasn't really listening to other people's records, you know. But I kind of felt like I went through the ringer, like with the major label stuff. And that's when I moved to, when Max and I moved up here, it was just the two of us. We built the band back up from scratch. And it was really more that, like, you know, we wanted to have a big city experience. I you know, growing up in Honolulu and then, living in Austin, I'd always wanted to live in, like, New York or Chicago or San Francisco and kind of get that feeling, that big city feeling. And then, you know, Chicago just kind of felt like, oh, Max was really, he had good friends here with, like, the Cocktails and different people. So he wanted to move here. And we were both like, all right, let's go check it out for a while.
How hard was it? I mean, that's one of the legacies of Poi Dog Pondering is how much you've changed the lineup. So many people have come through.
Yeah.
How hard was it for you and Max to find other musicians in Chicago to play in the band?
It wasn't hard. You know, I mean, no, it was hard. We went through a lot of different players.
Because it's a lot of instrumentation. It's not just, hey, can you play bass? You know,
like. Yeah. Some of it was literally like, you know, some friends of ours go, like, hey, I know this guy, Paul Mertens. He's a great sax player. You should call him up. Or Doc Julian. He's a great guitar player. You know, so we got turned on that way to people. And then we also auditioned, which is a terrible process. You know, you put an ad and then you sit in a room with people for three songs. And then you kind of go, we'll call you later, you know. And it's just a terrible process. But you also have to do it if you want to, especially for us to not know the city. And then,
that's when you put an ad in a reader, right? That's in the back. You're like, Poi Dog Pondering, looking for a bass player, inspirations.
Right. I did a lot of stuff where I would go through the clubs too. I mean, I would go through jazz clubs and reggae clubs, and I didn't really want rock players. I wanted people with a different sensibility. Yeah. So I went through all these other kind of clubs looking for, you know, players. And that's a nice way because you watch people in action. You can go, well, I like their style, you know. So you approach them.
Let's take a quick break so we can stay on time here.
Yeah.
Frank Orrell in studio with me, frontman for Poi Dog Pondering. Their latest record, which is out now, is Everybody's Got a Star. When we come back, let's talk about the 20th anniversary of Pomegranate. A great record, 1995. You just played shows at the Vic to celebrate that. I'd love to get your thoughts on making music 20 years ago and how it still stands up now.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that with Frank Orrell here on The Download. Stay with us.
Big constellation hanging over my head, a crooked and thorny starry crown, illumination shine a light on my dreams.
Some more Poi Dog Pondering for you here on WGN. It's a Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Frank Orrell. The front man for Poi Dog Pondering, we're talking about their career, their brand new record, which is out just this last month, is called Everybody's Got a Star. It's also the 20th anniversary of one of the better Chicago records of all time, Pomegranate, which you just heard a song off right there. Frank, for you, looking back, I mean, 20 years, you know, you just played, what was it like playing that record in its entirety at the Vic just last month?
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I mean, we released the record at the Vic, you know, like when we finished recording it. So, you know, we did those songs a lot in that room. So, I mean, it felt great to do it. And you know, those songs are, half of them are in our repertoire all the time. So it was really easy to pick up. There were a couple of songs that we don't play that often that were really nice to wake back up again.
Well, that's the idea.
It felt very natural.
You see that now much more in the last decade where bands are playing their full records and things like that. I mean, how hard is it for a band to do that, to say I'm going to play front to back just based on the fact some of those tracks you just don't play?
Yeah, it would depend on the album. You know, I mean, like you know, the you know, like some of our records have like if we were to do like NC Comes Fruit, it would be much more difficult because those are much more orchestrated. You know, there's a lot of orchestration and things like that. So, but not certainly not impossible for us to do, you know, like we have Paul and Susan and Max do great with the orchestration and with different musicians that they have join us on the show. So, but you know, some records, that one was an easy one to do because we, you know, played most of those songs. They're still in our repertoire.
Well, it was, you know, after the record, I guess it was after Volo Volo, which was a major label record. That was a major label album. Mm-hmm. Pomegranate was your own. That went independent.
Yeah.
What after the last major label record in 1993, 94, what made you leave?
You know, when we were, you know, we were not happy with Sony, and they were not happy with us. We had a great contract because we had six major labels after us. So we wrote a great contract that was like, we get to do instrumental records. We can do a kids record if we want. You know, we basically got full creative control with that Sony, that contract. But it's kind of a lot of lip service. I mean, and the truth is that we weren't selling records like they needed us to sell, like a major label needs to sell records. And we weren't playing ball. We were really stubborn. You know, that's just the way we are. We Volo Volo, the record we delivered for our third, you know, our that record, it was actually an all instrumental record, and they freaked out. They sent their A&R guy down to Austin, you know, like, and he's basically like going, we can release this record contractually, but we'll drop you right after.
Well, you had some hits on Wishing. I mean, Wishing Like a Mountain, Thinking Like the Sea, and you know, you had the appearance on Letterman, and you were moving in a direction where I'm sure Sony was happy, saying this is going to blossom into something that, you know, we're both going to be happy with.
Yeah, I mean,
but it wasn't in the cards.
No, yeah, I mean, they need to sell a lot of records to keep a band around. So we just, you know, yeah. But anyway, so like you know, we moved to Chicago, Max and I, and like, and the wind kind of went out of the sail of the Austin band. You know, I mean, we went on a tour and the label wasn't supporting the tour, and we felt like we worked really hard and did great work, and it wasn't really getting noticed. We were getting some stuff, but it's not in the level that you need to be to maintain that sort of thing. So then, you know, Max and I moved up here, and then we just started working on a new record. And when we sent the demos to the demos were what was going to be Pomegranate, we sent them to Sony, and they didn't like it, so they dropped us. And it was like, it was just so great. I mean, because now we don't have to deal with them anymore. And I felt like, you know, I felt like we got our integrity back. I mean, after 1 year and we working hard, practicing, writing, recording that record, when we did those, we did these Vic shows, and they were like so important to me. They were like, I remember feeling like I was not feeling well before. I was pretty sick, you know. I had like some kind of bad chest cold, and I was kind of, in the back of my mind, I was just going, just let me do these shows. That's all, you know. Yeah, I know it sounds dramatic, but I really kind of felt like anything could happen to me after this. I just want to do these shows, and it was a really nice moment. I mean, I really felt like, you know, it's a really great record, and it was good to, you know, to decide to close the door on signing with labels and start our own label. We had a great lawyer at the time, and that was before people were doing that. And he was like, "Going, why are you going to sign a new label? Why don't you just start your own label?" And it was like, "Well, you can do that." You know?
and the record, I mean, it stands the test of time. I mean, it was well received. Chicago loved it. I don't remember how it played out, you know, throughout the country. But the idea is that those songs, a lot of the songs that are off that record, are still, I feel like, are still in rotation.
Yeah, and it's great. XRT was super supportive of us. I mean, they are to this day. You know, like, well, you know, they were really one of the only you know, people, you know, to be playing the record, and that kind of support means a lot. It, you know, means a lot to the city. You get to broadcast, you know, like information out to the city in a way, you know?
Well, I know you brought your guitar and I know that I don't want to arm twist, but what do you think about playing something off of Pomegranate?
Sure. Yeah.
Keep it.
There you go.
I got to get my phone out. I got to tape this. Okay. So what are we going to hear?
I'll do a little bit of Catacombs.
Catacombs here on the download. Frank Oral.
I'm dusting off the old ghosts now, and they're giving me a run for my money. Down here with the skulls and bones, down here in the catacombs, swimming through the blood of years, chipping away at this wall of tears, with no muslin hands to hold me in the dark. I was left to find the light down here in the catacombs. Down here in the catacombs. Dilutes my thoughts. Words are like a string that I pull out of my mouth, like a tapeworm eating me from inside out. Words are like a string that I pull out of my
Frank Oral, Poor Dog Pondering, acoustic, Catacombs from Pomegranate, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary of the album. They just had shows. Poor Dog just had shows at the Vic. The new record is Everybody's Got a Star. More with Frank Oral when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. That's Burning Higher from the latest album, Everybody's Got a Star, from Poi Dog Pondering. Frank Oral in studio with me tonight on The Download here on WGN Radio. It's so prolific in the way that you listen to that music and you're like, oh, that's a funk track. Yeah. Frank's doing funk. Okay. Yeah. So talk about the new work. I mean, for you, I mean, all the band members I mentioned at the top, I mean, it feels like you've had 100 plus band members in Poi Dog Pondering. The lineups can get really big or really, you know, I would, small is relative. But talk about what you're doing now, you know, with Poi Dog.
Yeah, you know, we just finished this new record. It just literally just came out like 3 weeks ago. Everybody's Got a Star. And it's, you know, it's like a further exploration. I mean, I grew up in around dance clubs, you know, like in Hawaii, there was one club in town, really, the Wave, and it had to service everybody. So it was like, you know, punk rock kids, and, you know, until the early part of the evening, and then it went full disco, you know, afterwards, later on in the evening, 4 o'clock. And we were always used to mixing it up in that environment, you know, the punks and the disco kids and the mods and whatever, you know. So for me, like, that music's always been around me. And then coming to Chicago, definitely, it's such a great dance music town and electronic music town. And so that's always been a big influence. And then always like the rock and soul stuff that came out of here, like Tyrone Davis. And then the, you know, we really enjoy working with orchestral elements a lot. And those are all things that they really came to blossom when we came to Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, we did some shows with the Chicago Sinfonietta, you know, a couple of orchestral pieces with them. And so, you know, our records now they're kind of a pastiche of all that stuff. You know, you got this, the groove element. I'm a drummer, so for me, bass and drums are where my head is at, you know. And then, you know, have Susan, Max, and Paul doing orchestration, and the guitar players who are, you know, influenced by all these different things. And so, I mean, we're making our own records on our own label. We have complete freedom, you know, to do whatever we want. It feels good. I kind of feel like I'm right back to where I was in my bedroom with my little four track 30 years ago. making our own records. You know, we just make it.
Well, it's been a hallmark of Poor Dog Pondering, the fact that you do have so many influences. You'll hear you'll hear a record where you'll have eight, nine. I mean, even when you guys were in the major label stuff in the early 90s and you're on Letterman, there's 12 different people in the band. There's an accordion. You're up. You're platforms. I mean, you really do look like that band that's
right.
playing in the backyard. Like, but there's some bands that are like, okay, this is what we do. This is the box that we're going to play in, and we do this kind of rock and roll, and this is the genre we play in.
Right.
Poor Dog Pondering defies that.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that? What is it about inspiration and your philosophy that breeds that?
To me, it feels very natural. You know, as a musician, you're always listening, you know, and so you're being inspired by stuff, you know, and you let it come into you. You know, like lately I've been listening to a lot of Brazilian music, so like their chords, they're using a lot of jazz chords, and, you know, I stopped using a pick because all the Brazilian guys, they play with their hands, you know. So, like, I wanted to get to know what that was like. And you just incorporate these things in. And to me, it feels really natural to think that you have a sound and that you have to make your record sound like your mm-hmm. sound seems unnatural to me. You know what I mean?
Right. But are you, even early on when you had some hits that were hitting the radio and there was there ever a thought, well, we need to come up with another Poor Dog Pondering sounding hit?
I mean, I think we've always reacted completely opposite to that. You know, I mean, for better or for worse. I mean, you know, especially early on, we were kind of self-destructive. But, you know, like Columbia used to always go like, right, we need another Be the One. You know, that was the one that they got the most traction with. And you know, so the last thing we want to do is give them another Be the One, you know. But it's not because we're being difficult for being difficult's sake. I think that what we've felt is like if we just follow our heart, follow our intuition, wherever it goes, that's the most important thing. That's ultimately what you're broadcasting from the speakers at the end of the day. You're going like, this is where we are right now. We really mean it. This is what we're thinking lyrically. This is what we're interested in musically, and it's happening right now. And then the next time it's going to be something else. And we always have felt like that was the currency, is to like to be true to that thing. And people can hear that. They know when you're there.
For someone listening right now who's a Poor Dog fan who, you know, here on WGN, they're going to know two parts of Poor Dog. There's going to be, like you just mentioned, the stuff about recording, being independent, the sound, the instrumentation, changing things up record by record. The other part is your live performances. Mm. And that really has kept you... I don't want to use the word relevant, but in music that is, you know, you have to keep, but you have had such a great relationship with your fans to be able to play, whether it be Ravinia, whether it be the Vic, whether it be on a New Year's Eve, you seem to have a relationship to your audience that's in that space.
Yeah. I mean, the live, I love both things. I love the studio and I love the live. We're very respectful of our, you know, fans of the band. We don't go into show and just knock it out. Like, oh, just, you know, play the same set list. You know, we vehemently like change the set list every time, have a concept for the show when we go into it, have a performance idea. You know, you shape,
that's something you think
show,
about. Yeah.
Months before we only play like three or four locations a year, you know? And so when we do those are well thought out shows, you know? And I love going on stage and knowing that we got something up our sleeve. You know, at some point, Housematic Dance Troupe's going to come out. Or at some point, you know, we can pull the string orchestra is going to, you know, do something. You know, or like, you know, or there's going to be a light suit. You know, or
the... I mentioned earlier on in the interview, I kind of referred to you as a working musician.
Mm-hmm.
For you, you know, obviously doing shows, live shows, has been a big. That's been the big part of Poor Dog Pondering.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you get older, does it change? I mean, you just said you only do three or four shows a year. What changes as you get older as a working musician? I mean, is it the same kind of thing to pull up the bootstraps and we got to play on the streets, you know, like you did when you started
right.
to what's Poor Dog now?
You know, I mean, that's we've always, you know, when I was in Hawaii coming up, we used to play five nights a week in the same club. And I knew that was a dead end. You know, when I saw that, I was like going like, that's no way, you know. I Jesus and Mary Chain would go out and, you know, do 20 minutes on stage and walk off stage. You know, I was like, you know, I mean, that was much, much. You know, in other words, like, you know, make it special. Don't blow it all. Don't go out there, be out there all the time. Save up for it, do it special. And that's something that we've done all the while. The thing that's changed for us over the years, not much has changed other than it's just impossible for us to tour, you mm-hmm. know, and that makes it difficult. We'll go out of town and we'll play like New York, or we'll play San Francisco, or maybe Denver, Phoenix, or
but
Austin.
That's a one-off,
and that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, like we
just we'll because people
will lose money doing that.
You got jobs and things like that.
You got to fly. You know, to make kind of music, you need at least 8 people. Our regular lineup is 15, but we need 8 people to under like, you know, on the road as a lean and mean machine. It's going to be 8 people to get that sound, and then you know we never sold that kind of records to make it pay for itself. So we can never really do it. We still do it. We save money from shows here and we fly to New York. We have a great weekend and we play, you know, a couple shows there and then we come back. We lose some money, you know, we go in the hole, but we had a great time. And so we do that, you know, but what I do is that my thing is that I live and work out of Chicago and it's a great place to work. We got a great support. We can do the shows that we want to do, the big production shows, you know, walk into the Vic Theater or the Metro mm-hmm. or the Paramount or wherever and do like a big production show. And we can also make our records. We make our records out of our houses. You know, we record them. My living room's got mics in there right now, you know. So and then we release the records on our own label. And then I lick the stamps, you know, at the house to mail the records.
It seems
out.
Like you guys were, you know, ahead of your time. I mean, it seems like now bands, that's how you have to do it if you want to make it in this new music industry. You guys have been doing this since 1995.
Right. Yeah.
So Frank Orrell, Poor Dog Pondering. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I got to ask you about Chicago.
Sure.
You know, that we've had a lot of fun in these interviews, just getting your take on the philosophy of why you stayed here, what you think of this town,
mm-hmm.
and what this town has given Poor Dog Pondering.
Yeah.
The new records, Everybody Got a Star, Everybody's Got a Star. Frank Orrell in studio with me here on The Download. Stay with us, everybody. When I wake in the morning, little Poor Dog Pondering from the new record, When I Wake in the Morning, from their latest Everybody's Got a Star. Frank Orrell in studio with me, talking about the band Poor Dog Pondering, their career, their new stuff, and also about making music here in Chicago, because that's something that Poor Dog Pondering, I mean, you're from Honolulu, mm-hmm. you were in Austin, you talked about Austin, you came to Chicago, but you stayed.
Yeah.
What kept you in particular here in Chicago?
I think it's a really good working city. I mean, on a number of levels, but say for me creatively, as a creative person, it's a really easy person. It's a really place to live. It's affordable to live, you know, like New York. I watch my friends who are in bands in New York and they were struggling. You know, they would put a band together. If the band didn't make it within 6 months, like what they thought the way they should make it, like mm-hmm. then they would just break up and form a new band, like because they thought the formula's
wrong. You're right.
That's,
you know? That's a great point that I have not heard made, just about the idea of affordability of life.
Yeah,
gives you a little bit more time to make your creative projects work.
Yeah, the city's laid out great, and it's a large city, so it's got a lot of stimulation going on. There's a lot of things going on in. You know, it's a racially mixed city. That's important to me. And, you know, and so, yeah, it's been I've really enjoyed this. I love the city.
Well, you know, I'm always interested in the relationship between a city and a band,
mm-hmm.
because you get that a lot. And it feels like the fans put that on. This band's from Chicago. This band's from San Francisco. Oh, Bay Area band. Just reading something about Metallica. Bay Area band. But, for you, what does it mean when people say Poor Dog Pondering is a Chicago band?
I have a different look at it because, you know, it's been a Hawaii band and it's been a Austin band and it's been a Chicago band and it's got all three of those elements in it now, you know. But it definitely, you know, we've been here 20 years and 22 years living and working here and the band is mostly Chicagoans, you know, and so, yeah, We're a Chicago band.
Well, I mean, one of the things that, when I talk to people about Chicago, we never really get into just the support systems.
Yeah.
Chicago, you've developed relationships with the Metro, with the Vic. You mentioned the Vic, different places. How is it for, as being a working musician, for Chicago? I mean, is it easy for you to find a place to work, easy for you to find a place to record, easy for you to find a place to play?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, for instance, you know, L.A. is just, it's really hard to find a place to play in L.A. You know, I mean, they've got a lot of, like, not such good rooms, you know. But I guess let me put it this, it's easy for me. We've recorded, every record we've recorded in a different space. You know, like Pomegranate, we rented a disused basketball gym in Cabrini Green and tracked the record inside there. And then for Natural Thing, we had a little space on Fullerton and Western, like a little, you know. So each record, we've gone into like a different environment, you know, and only every once in a while I use a proper studio. I think Seven we did in a proper studio. But we've always rented spaces and then made them our own and then worked out.
What was the intention?
When you go into a regular studio, you're recording by the hour. And it shows, you know, the band members go like, oh, you know, I got to get this guitar solo, one more take and then we got to move on, you know?
Right.
And then, but if we're in the studio and we like to go in somewhere and, you know, like put stuff up on the wall, nail lyrics to the wall, you know, put out bed rolls, bring in a hot plate and, you know, cook pasta in there. I'll take the night shift. I'll stay up all night. And then someone will come in, Martin or Ted will come in during the day and track people during the day. And then I'll pick up the ball and at night, you know? So, I mean, we can keep the engine room going. It's a creative hotbed, you know. I think when you take over a space and make it your own for recording, that's why.
You know, you mentioned earlier about touring, the idea that you need 8 people to really get the Poi Dog sound. But there's 15 people in the band.
Yeah.
For young musicians who are starting out, who may want to have or are drawn to that kind of vibe, something that's bigger instrumentation, more of a creative palette when it comes to music. What's your advice to someone who wants to start something like a Poi Dog Pondering, a big, you know, 8-person, 15-person band?
Yeah, I mean, do it, you know. I mean, because the nice thing is that now you have this palette, you know, with all these colors on it to add to the song. And then also the audience loves it because they're like going, wow, okay, wow, there's an accordion. Okay, there's a, you know, or whatever the instruments, you know, that you have on stage, and they get to see those instruments at work. And you know, it's not hard. I mean, you know, also you can do stuff, you know, like we were sleeping in sleeping bags on the outskirts of town and then coming into town. I mean, in other words, it's how much do you want to do it? You can find a way to do it. You know, we had a little beatbox and we were copying the cassettes while we were driving from town to town and selling them on the street. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you just find a way, you know, I mean, and my thing is that I think that if you get creative and you think about, like my thing has always been, I had a friend of mine who like said, like, you know, like, I forget how he said it, but, you know, best quality under the circumstances. You know, you might not be able to record in a studio. You might not be able, you know, but you just find a way to get it done. The important thing is getting the idea done, you know? So.
This is awesome to have you here, man.
Thanks. I appreciate it, man. I really appreciate you having
Poi Dog
me
Pondering has been, as much as it has been an Austin band and obviously a Hawaii band, it is a Chicago band. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't go a year without seeing huge Poi Dog shows being advertised. And, you know, your relationship to New Year's, and it always feels like there's a Poi Dog show on New Year's.
Right.
You know, you've given a lot to this community, and we look forward to more work.
Thank you, man.
And stay here.
That.
Don't go anywhere else. Just stay here.
No, we're here. We're here for the count.
The latest album is called Everybody's Got a Star. Frank Orle, Poi Dog Pondering. Thanks for being my guest.
Thanks. I appreciate it, brother.
It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez with Pretty Late, Patty Vasquez. In the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about sports, actually the business of sports. We're going to talk about contracts, a big part. It's become almost the secondary part of sports, who won the game and who signed to what contract. So we'll talk about what we need to know about, in particular, the football team in Chicago, the Chicago Bears, a lot of the players that are actually doing great things this year, have very peculiar contracts. So we'll talk about that with a writer from Forbes. Also coming up, we're going to talk about the Neil Simon play, Chapter 2, which is at the Windy City Playhouse, a show about relationships from 1977. We'll see if that plays here in 2015. But right now, let's talk art. I'm so excited about this conversation. This is one that I've been trying to get on the books for a while. My next guest is a fixture on the Chicago art scene. Her self-titled gallery, Monique Milosh, is one of the more recognizable galleries in the city. It's along Division Street in Wicker Park, Bucktown. Milosh has been working in galleries for over 20 years. Before her own space, she worked at the Museum of Contemporary Art and Rona Hoffman. Milosh has been instrumental in giving new artists a look, as well as working with the city to make sure that Chicago is represented and respected as a player that it should be when it comes to the art world. Monique Milosh, welcome to The Download.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. Like I said, I'm very excited to talk about this because this is an area that I'm very curious about and I know not a lot about, the industry, the art gallery scene, the fine art scene here in Chicago. You know, just trying to schedule this interview, you had time and you just got back from Italy. Then you went to New York. Next week, you're going to Miami for Basel. That's a big part of your job as the owner of your gallery.
Definitely. I've had my own gallery here for now about 15 years. And I love having my gallery here in Chicago. And I do not plan on moving it anywhere else. But I play on a global field. And so I have to participate in a global market, which in contemporary art, it involves art fairs, international art fairs, which is what I just did in Italy. I supported a young artist from Minneapolis there, Nate Young, with a solo show at the fair there. Then I flew there from New York, where Ebony G. Patterson, a young artist from Jamaica, who I work with, had a solo show opening at the Museum of Arts and Design, her first solo show at a museum in New York. And then I come back here, and then I quickly do my laundry and pack some more art. And
that's a big part of it, right? The idea that you need to go and be present at art fairs.
Art fairs, and also supporting my artists at their other exhibitions all over the world, whether it's at other galleries or museums. It's really, it's a relationship-driven business, and I have 15 artists who I'm their primary representative. It's like in the music industry, right? Like I'm their agent.
Okay.
And so I'm going to support them around the globe with whatever they do. And if I can do it, or if I can't be there, maybe there's another member of my staff who can, like fly to Seattle or go to Miami or go wherever.
How do you find the artists? Obviously there are several, artists in Chicago making their names, but how do you, Monique Milosh, how do you find the artists that you end up representing?
I'm always looking because you can never not be looking. I think that's something you really have to embrace. But, I take advantage of the fact that here in Chicago we have amazing art schools. We have the School of the Art Institute, we have University of Chicago, we have UIC, we have Northwestern, we have DePaul. We have so many incredible artists coming through our city that I take full advantage of being like first on the ground, like, oh, of course I'm going to go through their MFA studio and see them before anybody else. So you'll see a great deal of artists in my roster who maybe they don't live in Chicago anymore, but they certainly went to school here. But then wherever I travel, I call my colleagues or I call other artists who I know and say, whose studio should I visit? Who should I be talking to? Or I have collectors who call me and say, oh my God, there's this person that you should be looking at. So it's, you should always be looking, but, I don't represent a million people. I represent a very small group that I work really hard for.
Well, for you, your background, you worked at MCA, you worked with Rona Hoffman, you've worked in a lot of different places. What was the impetus for you to start your own gallery?
It was definitely not what I thought I was going to do. I have a master's degree in art history and theory from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which is what brought me to the city. And I got my job at the MCA while I was still at grad school. Totally thought, like, I'm going to be in academia, I'm going to teach, or I'm going to work at an institution. And, after 6 years at the Museum of Contemporary Art, it kind of was like, well, things have played out, and like, what do you do? Well, the next thing for like a curator is move to another city, and mm-hmm. I really didn't want to move to another city. I really love Chicago so much for so many reasons, and you know, I reached out to Rona Hoffman saying, hey, like, I can come to you as a young curator, and maybe we could work together. And just, you know, it's like, as things played out, it's like the more decision making I got, the more I was like, oh, well, maybe my name should be on the door. And it just kind of like fell into place. It was not a plan. And certainly when I opened my gallery in my house in 2000 with a show called Homewrecker, my husband was not
appropriately
too thrilled. You know, he wanted to get it out of the house as quickly as possible. So, yeah, and it's the right thing for me, but I didn't know that was the right thing for me.
Well, let's talk. When we come back, let's talk about that gallery scene, because a lot of people who might be listening now, me included, you know, I have a lot of questions about how it works. You know, where is the scene? Just when gallery shows open, how connected the industry here is in Chicago. Monique Milosh in studio with me from Monique Milosh Gallery. When we come back, we'll talk more with her about the art scene here in Chicago on The Download. Stay with us. Back here in The Download, Monique Milosh Gallery. You didn't think about naming it something different, something like alt rock, something that's like
yeah.
You know, something cool.
Space. No, you know, I felt like I really wanted to put my name on the door by the time I got there.
There you got it, right? Monique Milosh Gallery, which is in on Division Street in Bucktown, Wicker Park. We're talking about the art scene, the gallery scene here in Chicago. I feel like that's a really big part of Chicago's vibrant sort of arts and culture scene. There are galleries all over the place, and I don't. I always feel like I don't know how to enter, and I don't mean through the front door, but I just don't know the ins and outs. Now, when you first set up your gallery, it was in the West Loop,
yes.
And it seems like that was the space for a while. At least it is now, where a lot of galleries set up.
Yeah, it's still. I mean, the West Loop is definitely where the majority of the contemporary art. Galleries in Chicago are agglomerated. You still have River North, but then you have these, like myself, like you have these outliers, and you have people in Pilsen, and you have people in Logan Square. And, you know, I think that like Chicago is a really big and vibrant art scene, but we're not like Chelsea or the Lower East Side in New York. There's not that much density. Mm-hmm. So it's okay if we're spread out. And, you know, people will take the time to go there. And Chicago also has a really, really cool history of artist-run spaces. And, you know, we have so many great art schools, like that's, yeah, you know, right. Like I said, where I go and look for artists who, during their time here, they will, like, open up their apartment and run apartment galleries. And so it's like there's this – people will go and investigate and do that, but – how do you see all of these things?
I remember when I this would be 10 years ago, being in the West Loop on a Friday night, and mm-hmm. they would coordinate to where there were all these parties. It would be a wine and cheese fest, like down yeah. Washington or Randolph.
Yeah.
And you would go jump from place to place to place. It wasn't necessarily for the idea of buying anything in the place. It just felt like it was part of a community.
It totally is. And we all try to do that, whether it's a first Friday or a Saturday afternoon or whatever. Everybody's kind of trying to figure it out to make it easier for people to navigate and, you know, to get the word out, whatever it is in local media or just on our own social media. Mm-hmm. You know, because we are, you know, commercial galleries are free and open to the public. And it's something that sometimes people still ask me, you know, does it cost to come to my yeah. gallery? I'm like, no, you can come in and you can.
There's a lot of misconceptions. I mean, there's the price. You're going to walk in there and you feel like, geez, what did I just walk into? And you're going to walk up to me and say, that piece is $45,000. You can't be in here.
But I mean, you know, like I realize that 95% of the people who walk in my gallery are not buying anything.
Right.
I have school groups who come in. I do a public art project called On the Wall in my the facade of my building that's lit 24 hours a day that my Wicker Park Bucktown SSA actually helps me fund that because they view it as public art. It's for a service for our public that after our doors close at 6 p.m., that's when our greatest audience is seeing all that stuff. That stuff's not for sale. that's like for me kind of flexing my curatorial arm and being able to do something that gives back and means something and that creates a dialogue. And maybe somebody will come back a week later and be like, what is that thing that's in your window?
You know, we talked at the beginning about art fairs. Mm-hmm. And Chicago has had a long history with art fairs, Expo Chicago being one of them. But the where, you know, Chicago has been the place for this country to be the epicenter. I mean, there have been a lot of art fairs here in Chicago, but that's changed over the years. What kind of city is Chicago when it comes to art?
It's a really important city in terms of art and architecture and culture. And I think that, you know, our art fair now, Expo Chicago, which is now in its fourth year coming back, has really put us back on the map, especially changing its dates to September and really coming together with all the institutions. Years ago, in the early 90s, Chicago was the place for contemporary art.
Okay.
And then the art fair in Miami, which started in Basel and kind of like took over. And Miami's a little sexier than Chicago, specifically in December.
Specifically around this time, yeah.
but, you know, Chicago is still a place where people come for, you know, to feed their culture. And I think it's got a spot. And I am fully on board. I started Gallery Week in Chicago years ago with the mayor's
support. You've been
a big player.
Yeah, you've been a big player in that. And what does Chicago have to do? I mean, if you just think about it just like an industry, any industry, whether it be the culinary industry or textiles or art, mm-hmm. What does Chicago have to do to take that back from Miami? I mean, is it more from the mayor, from initiatives at City Hall to say, we're going to try and bring that industry back to Chicago so Chicago can be the epicenter of art in America?
I don't think that Chicago is going to be the epicenter because you have New York, you've got LA, you've got the coast, everybody's doing their own things. But I think the center, Chicago, is very important. And I think we're on track to doing what we need to do and refocusing and working together with the art, with the institutions, with the architecture, with the city, with everything, with the food,
schools, yeah.
everything yeah, 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 you've got yeah. together and pulling it together in the most glorious time in September where it's like it's wonderful in the city and the art world is already putting their best foot forward. So it's kind of like the perfect storm, and I think we've got it figured out now where everyone's like putting Chicago on the map. Like, okay, that third or fourth week in September, whenever that fair is, that's where we come to Chicago. And then people know, oh, that first week in December, that's when we go to Miami. And then if you get that on a yearly roll, I think we're good.
Big show coming up for you at the Art Institute that's coming up in January. Obviously, Chicago has the Art Institute. We haven't even talked about how the museums and the institutions here play. You know, they have the School of the Art Institute as well. For you, talk about that show because it's an alumni show.
So there's a huge alumni show. The School of the Art Institute is having their 150th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And many departments of the Art Institute are celebrating that. And so there are many of my artists, Rashid Johnson, Sanford Biggers, Justin Cooper, Carrie Schneider. They are all been featured at various different levels at the museums. We're super excited that Carrie Schneider, for the first time, is having her photograph, major, major photograph, that she took while she was a MFA student at the School of the Art Institute, acquired by the Art Institute, will be on view for the first time.
Wow.
And then she has a huge show that opens up at the Haggerty Museum in January at the same time. So we're kind of just, all of my artists right now are doing so amazing things, and they're all just like kind of going crazy. Like her as a young girl from like Gurnee, Illinois, was like, I went to the Art Institute and I always thought I will have something on that wall. And she's really having that happen. And that's pretty amazing.
Okay, so that's coming up in January for the big 150th anniversary. Monique Milosh, I can't thank you enough for coming in. I'd love to have you back. I'd love to continue the conversation because just for my own purpose, I don't know enough about the art scene here in Chicago, and I feel like a lot of times media just ignores talking about it because they can't understand it. I'm not going to just feel like
it's really rich and it's really easy and it's really, really open for people to come and see.
Well, you can check out Monique Milosh Gallery, which is on Division Street over, it's like Levitt, right?
Yep.
Division Levitt and in Wicker Park, Bucktown. Monique, thanks for coming in and talking with us tonight.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock when Patty Vasquez takes over with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to talk Bears contracts. I'm excited to talk about this, the business side of sports. Everyone, maybe, I don't know, say 6 weeks ago, Pete, probably about 6 weeks ago, everyone's like, how do we get out of this Jay Cutler contract? Right? That was that. It became like nobody cared about what he was doing on the field. They're just like, is it easy to get out? How much? What's the salary cap?
Get rid of this guy.
Yeah, got to get rid of this guy. Well, what do we do now? Now it's like, well, maybe he's got a good contract. You know, maybe we keep his contract for a couple of years if he's actually going to play like this consistently. And then you have the questions we talked about yesterday about Jeremy Langford, the rookies on a rookie contract. Matt Forte is an unrestricted free agent. Alshon Jeffrey is coming up as a free agent. So there's a lot of questions about the finances around the Chicago Bears and what their philosophy is. So we'll talk about the finances of pro sports coming up in 10
I'll be
o'clock.
Looking forward to that conversation.
There you go. There you go. That is the voice of Peter DeFaria, and Brian McCaskill is also in studio.
Hello.
Neil Simon is back on stage in Chicago. The Windy City Playhouse is producing Chapter 2, a Simon play that was nominated for a Tony back in 1978, a good year.
Right on.
The play features Peter, Brian, and a great cast of Chicago actors.
Amy J. Carl.
Amy Rubenstein, who's also the artistic director for Windy City Playhouse. The play's on stage till December 20th at the Playhouse, which is at 3014 West Irving Park Road. Brian, Peter, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Neil Simon. And we were talking a little bit in the break right before. It just feels like Neil Simon is the what you were supposed to read if you're in acting school. If you want to know anything about comedy.
Well, I think you got to read Chekhov first.
Right.
And then maybe you want to tackle Neil
Shakespeare,
Simon.
Shakespeare,
not so much.
Not so much.
But definitely after Chekhov.
Yes.
Neil Simon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a requirement. He's somebody who, you know, he's steeped in that tradition. He comes from that, and then, early TV.
Your show of shows.
It's Neil Simon, Woody Allen, Carl Reiner, all those guys. You know, it was all at the same place. And all that,
Larry Gephardt.
And it's all of that quick writing that they had to do back in the day, and they had to produce it, you know, they had to produce it regularly, live,
Your
show of shows. So, yeah.
Now, Peter, you just came off The Odd Couple at Northlight, so you did Neil Simon a little bit.
Yes.
For you, what attracted you to a Neil Simon project?
He's so funny. No, he's, you know, it's I like this play especially. It's complicated. It's weird. It's funny, and then it's got some serious parts too. So, you know, that's what attracted me, and a great part. So there you go.
This is I guess you would say this is a little bit more of a lesser known Neil Simon play.
Yeah,
yeah.
But this play is a late 70s Neil Simon joint. A lot about relationships, and you know, I kind of teased it out earlier in the show just about what can a play about relationships from 1977 tell us about relationships in 2015. What does this play tell us about the way we interact with each other, our relationships that are happening? You know, now it's interesting that this is being produced now just for that fact. There are a lot of different things that are happening now than were in 1977.
Yeah. One thing you had to deal with a rotary phone.
Yes, rotary phones are huge.
That's
a plot device. That actually works out really well because it's you can characters can miss each other because the phone will be busy. There's no answering machine. But as far as like the themes of the play, the thing that makes it hold up is it is so universal. It's people dealing with loss and relationships and infidelity and middle age and death. So it's all timeless. It's
all that
Simon,
great stuff.
All that great that fun stuff.
Yeah.
Come on out and see the death comedy. But, you know, it's the thing. It is one of those things that great comic writers can. Like, they'll take very tragic themes and they'll write about them in a way that actually enlightens and, you know, makes it, you know, sort of a, you know, an enjoyable experience. And that's the thing that sort of, even with all the 70s funkiness and all that stuff, it's still sort of, that's the part that...
Were you familiar with the play before getting involved in this project?
Yeah, vaguely, but I didn't want to read it again or see it again before I was going to do it. Because it's a James Caan movie.
And James Caan.
No one can see me, but I'm not a James Caan type. I'm an innocuous white man, and I'm not. I don't look at all like James Caan.
Sonny Corleone.
I'm not a Sonny Corleone type.
Rollerball.
It's one of those things that I'm vaguely familiar with it, but going back and reading it, it was interesting because it's his first foray into something dark. It is about his first wife dying, and it's the first time a very, very successful comedy writer said, all right, I'm going to write about death, and I'm going to write about my wife and how difficult it was to move on. So that's kind of the interesting thing about it, and it is still a comedy.
What attracted you to this project, Peter?
The wardrobe. the different fabrics I get to wear on stage.
She looks very sexy.
The facial hair.
Sure.
What else?
Polyester.
Polyester. Yeah, just the chemical fabrics.
Chemical fabrics
of the day. The disco.
You strike me as a disco fan.
Right?
When I saw you, I was like, oh, disco fan.
Disco guy. Yeah,
you and I, we're both disco fans.
And you know, to be honest with you, I was one of those guys that in the 70s, that was like, oh, disco sucks. I was lying. I always really liked disco. I mean, come on.
True confessions here on WGN.
Yeah, on WGN. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, Peter, I mean, was it the same? Brian talked about this being a departure for Neil Simon in the way that, you know, he went dark. Is that well known? I mean, for you as someone who's, you know, acted in, you did Odd Couple, is that something that attracted you to the project? Going, oh, this is something that's not that this isn't the Neil Simon that everybody knows.
Definitely. And when I tell people that I'm doing this play, they're like, oh, you're doing that Neil Simon play? Like, really? that's a difficult one, isn't it? You know? So yeah, I mean, there was definitely a challenge there. I think that we're rising and meeting that challenge, but some difficult topics, you know, in the show. And yeah, that was very attractive.
Well, we're talking with Brian McCaskill and Peter DeFaria, two actors that are in Chapter 2, which is a Neil Simon play that's at the Windy City Playhouse. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about both of you have been big players in Chicago theater for a while now, and I'd love to talk to you about big players, big players, big puns.
Yeah, so,
well, if you say so.
Yeah. We'll talk more with these guys about Chicago theater when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests in studio, Peter DeFaria, Brian McCaskill, two Chicago actors who are part of the Neil Simon play Chapter 2, which is at the Windy City Playhouse on 3014 West Irving Park Road till December 20th. It's a good time to be a Chicago actor. Both of you get work on television.
It's a great time.
Yeah,
it's great. Very exciting.
So talk about that, because it seems more often, I mean, my Facebook feed, I have friends with a lot of actors, is just filled with, tonight I'm going to be
I'll be
second
appearing
cop.
On
I'll
this
be
on, yeah. On a, yeah. On a on Chicago Sanitation or Chicago Diner.
But it really is, like in the last, I would say the last 2 years or so, to being a Chicago actor, you can get a lot of work in television.
God bless Dick Wolf. And God bless
Dick,
Claire Simon.
It's all Dick, yeah. Well, thank you, Dick Wolf, for coming to town.
And yeah, coming to town.
Whatever the next Chicago is, we'd love to.
Giving us all a reel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. But, I mean, for both of you, I mean, being Chicago actors and being working actors on stage, you know, to be able to have that outlet, to be able to go to television to do day parts, to do recurring characters, things like that, how does it work for you? I mean, is it helping not only just your bottom line, but like you said, your reel? Is it helping you get other gigs?
Get other things? Well, I mean, I'm sure it'll help me get another part on, you know, hopefully Chicago Med, because you do Chicago Fire and then you do Chicago PD. Now we got this new one coming up, I can be a policeman and walk through that show, you know, anytime.
Yeah, but it's also the other thing that's really nice about it, it's also an advertising hub. So is the commercial work is really that pads that allows you to do. That's the stuff that allows you to do the theater and all that stuff.
Right.
So it really there's enough work around here, especially with the commercial work. And people come here for commercials because of the improv community and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like they get a good it's like a bumper crop of like funny actors and stuff. So they really like shooting them into. And the commercials really allow you to it's just it's
live,
nice.
Survive.
Yeah, it can be thrive one or two and days of a shoot, and then you get a good amount of money from them, and it allows you to, and then you can string all the other stuff together. It's a nice city for that. It really is.
You know, Chicago has been one of those towns, I would think, for theater where if you don't have that, you're really going to be working a day job during the day and picking up rehearsals at night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And everybody did in the beginning. I mean, like when everybody started out, everybody had day jobs.
I still have a day job.
Peter still has a day job. But it is one of those things that if you can piece things together, then it really does it's a nice city for that. It really is. There's a lot of opportunities. And there's more. I mean, there's we've got studios here, and people are building all the time and expanding on that. And more people are coming here and shooting.
Occasionally they shoot a movie here. Nice tax breaks, I guess, again, which is great.
It is. And it's also the theater community is really supportive, and you can have places. And as opposed to New York, it's a place where you can start a new equity house, like Windy City Playhouse. You can start one here, and it can be successful. And like it's at its first season. We're already
right from the jump,
adding
daddy
matinees in the first season of a new theater company. So to have that level of success in New York with the rents and the level and the pressure and all that, you can get shut down right away.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Here is a place where you have the support of the community and the support of the neighborhood and of the acting community.
And the media.
And you can really get a company to take
on. It's fascinating, too, because it's a through line for someone who's listening to the download tonight. We talked to Frank Orrell from Poi Dog Pondering earlier in the show. And he talked about, from a musician's standpoint and his friends who are in New York City, the level in which they had to make it time-wise is different. When you live in New York, because of the rent, because of the lifestyle, you only have 4 months, 6 months to make it as a band, and then you got to give up. Yeah. I would assume it's the same with theater, where you really don't afford yourself enough time creatively to be able to find a living, find your niche, be an act, working actor, find the projects. If some of those things that, you know, like rent and other things are too
mortgages
high,
and all sorts of things.
And the other thing is that the just Chicago is one of the hubs of black box theater, of smaller scale theaters, like 100 to 300 seat theaters, which are my favorite theaters to perform in. Because there's an intimacy with the audience that you can't get. Believe me, I've loved performing at Lyric, too. It's just I have no idea who I'm performing to beyond the first three rows. I have no idea. So it's nice to have the connection. And it's like there's a lot of theaters like that. And there's so many of them. So it's nice to be able to have the opportunities to work with people and great directors. And
you know,
I'm
fascinated because it's always been in Chicago, especially in the theater community, the idea that this is a place where you can take risks. This is a place where you can be creative.
Yeah, it's a real supportive community.
Right. But the downside was always, well, people may not be paying attention. The people who are going to give you paychecks, the people who may, it's not unlike, you know, why people move to Los Angeles to go work on TV. They want to go where the industry's at. There's no industry here. Yeah. But that has changed in some respects with some of the television, like you said, the advertising.
Right.
So are we entering a different age of Chicago theater?
Renting the golden age of Chicago theater. I don't know. Boy, that's an interesting question. I guess so. You know, I guess there's a lot more opportunities out there.
I think we are. I think we're at a place.
Yeah, a lot more like, companies are.
When I graduated college, I mean, it's a place now where it wasn't the Wall Street Journal, New York Times didn't regularly come here to review. Obviously, the big theaters, but now they'll come and they'll review the black box theaters.
Yeah, sure.
And they do that regularly now. So we're at a place now where people are, where somebody's comfortable enough saying, you know what, I'm going to launch three television series here because the talent's good enough that they may pull their leads from here and there, but they're like, you know what, there's enough talent here that I can start an industry. I can start a cottage industry of shows that start with Chicago.
I know, Chicago Fire has been
And just like shop that out and keep that going, and it works. And they're good shows. They hold up, you know, and it's like, and that helps a lot. And I think it comes from being here in the theater community. I think the improv community was a huge boost in that, too. I think that's what I think the comedy talent that's here is tremendous, too, and I think that brought a lot of business here. I wish there was more sitcoms. I wish there was more comic situation shows. There's a lot of drama, and I feel uncomfortable drawing a gun on someone, so I always look silly at the auditions. I was on Chicago PD. I played a dry cleaner who got beat up because that's the only thing I can play. I would love to pull a gun on someone and say, don't move, but it's ridiculous. So, He can play a cop. He's played cops. You're a tough guy.
You need to get on a novella. I think. Yeah. I think that's what you're.
But I'm
market
like
is.
I'm the guy who gets beat up. I auditioned for Empire. I was a guy who
didn't
like,
I beat you up once?
No, on Empire, the dad was going to beat me up for giving the kid drugs. On Chicago PD, I got beat up because I borrowed money from the mob.
Oh, but then I beat you up on that. Right?
I was going to be in an episode of Chicago Fire where I got beat up by a firefighter because I did something to a girl.
You shouldn't have done that.
Right? Yeah. So. So if they could bring comedy in, that would be great. So I could stop getting beat up.
But right now, you've got.
He's the guy you love to beat up.
You cornered the market on the guys who get beat up.
Right.
I mean, so why change things?
I'd rather be typecast.
I'm
going to
beat him up right now.
Right?
Beat him up on your show?
If your listeners want to come by, they could come and punch me in the stomach.
We were giving away Lou Malnati's pizzas, but instead,
come on down.
Come down and
take a shot at Brian McCaskill.
I'm like, you're going to come in. I'm not threatening at all. You'll be like, yeah, I could hit him. I could take him.
I can get away with that.
That guy.
And he's very tall.
Yeah, he's tall. Yeah, but lanky. You know, not
lanky.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we may just. So if you see Brian McCaskill on the street, you know,
hey,
just,
come on.
Yeah, you know. Come on. Take a
We're
shot.
Just kidding around here.
We're kidding
in the
around.
Studio. Don't take
We're
a
kidding
shot.
Around.
At Brian.
Don't take a shot. This is acting. Well. It's acting. Brian McCaskill, Peter DeFaria, two of the leads in the show. Chapter 2, the Neil Simon play that was nominated for a Tony back in 1978. It's on stage at the Windy City Playhouse up in 3014 West Irving Park Road.
I know.
Until December 20th. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming down and speaking with me tonight.
Thank you for
thank
having
you.
Us.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's a download here on WGN, the home stretch here in the 10 o'clock hour. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez. I'm excited this hour, you know, because we're going to talk about sports, which we do a lot on this program. But I want to talk about is the business side of it, because so many storylines coming out of at least the Bears camp around contracts, whether it be Jay Cutler, Matt Forte, Alshon Jeffrey. You know, I thought John Gruden was going to have a coronary on Monday Night Football. He was talking about Adam Gase, another, you know, the offensive coordinator. This guy is going to be a head coach someday. And, you know, and that has sort of been the storyline of the Chicago Bears, that they're going to lose their offensive coordinator, and he's been a big problem. But there's some bigger storylines there, players included, coming up here that have to do with their contracts. So that's what we're going to talk about now. Joining me in the studio, Frank Thurber. He's reported on these issues. He just wrote a couple pieces for Forbes Sports Money. Frank, good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is your area of expertise, and I'm excited to have you here. Why don't we start with Jay Cutler? Because last year I felt like Jay Cutler, everyone's like, man, even the beginning of this year, the first couple games are like, how do you cut him? Right. How much of a casualty will he be? The tone has changed in Chicago because he's had a couple successful games. He's shown some consistency. Now the argument's, well, how does his contract work for us? What is the status of a Jay Cutler contract?
Well, you know, it's funny. It really is reflective of not only quarterbacks, but a lot of the predominant players at their respective positions, particularly those who were drafted in 2011. Or thereafter, really. The good news for Bears fans out there is that over half, believe it or not, of his next year's, so 2016 league year, the base salary, which is pretty much all of the compensation, is accounted for already. So that's just a little bit into, you know, how complex and ambiguous, I guess, the language
so the idea,
how deep they can go.
The Cutler contract, which is a very famous one here in Chicago, was he got all his money kind of in the first couple years,
right.
And then it kind of is on a sliding scale downward as he gets to the back end of that contract.
Yes and no. You know, guys at the quarterback position, you know, that you would label a franchise player, Aaron Rodgers, Andrew Luck, Jay, Russell Wilson now, as of the last few months, the big paycheck, now obviously, relatively speaking, it's all big money in that business, but the big paycheck, relatively speaking, is in the signing bonus. The plus side of that for the teams and the fans who, you know, root for retaining, you know, players that are worth it in their eyes, is that the cap implications of a signing bonus are divvied throughout the life of a contract. So that implication, as you get further into it, is much less formidable, if you will, for players that, that receive that type of deal. Now, at the quarterback spot, the base salaries can get hefty. Jay's due, I think, $16 million in a base salary alone next year. Now, but what I referred to earlier was that a lot of that, $10 million, if I remember correctly, is already accounted for because he was on the roster by the second or third, something like that,
so
league day of this, this year. Right, some of it, at least. So they're already on the hook for $10 million. So
they can't really cut the guy.
Well, they could. It's much more feasible now than it was. They would take about a $6.5-7 million cap hit
if they traded him, or not traded him, but
if they were to release him, right? Yes, next year. Yeah. So Ryan Pace and the McCaskies and Mr. Phillips are stuck with the decision of what is more in our favor, parting ways and taking the $7 million hit, or sticking with him in hopes of continued performance, like Bears have seen as of late, or just, getting through it until it becomes even more feasible and less of a
Pete and I last night were talking about Matt Forte and Jeremy Langford. Jeremy Langford, and we are you're the expert, but Pete and I came up with the idea that, it seems like the NFL is going in a direction where the valued prize, what everybody's after, what the sought after, every GM is going after, is that rookie contract.
Right.
The idea that because that is a standard contract. That is, you get paid $450,000, and that's what you get for 3 years, right?
Well, it increases by year, but it's a league.
The idea is it's not
amount.
$16 million.
Right. Exactly.
They can't even negotiate. It's pretty much a straight deal.
Correct.
So Jeremy Langford to the Bears is much more valuable than an expiring contract that's unrestricted to Matt Forte. It really doesn't even have anything to do about production.
Right.
It's just they're going to save millions of dollars.
Exactly, right. And you saw that with Russell Wilson from his rookie year all the way through last year, through the Super Bowl year and then through the NFC Championship year last year. As much as John Schneider and Paul Allen and the rest of the administration and operations department in Renton, as much as they would not have wanted to restructure that until they had to, or renegotiate an entire new deal, they wouldn't have been able to.
The collective bargaining agreement is set.
Right, right. The rookies are not allowed to either renegotiate or receive a brand new contract until they have expired 3 years of their initial rookie deal. So it's much more team friendly, not only in that regards, but others as well. It's designed to allocate more money towards proven veterans as opposed to touted rookies, if you will.
So, and we'll take a break in just a second here, but sure. But the Bears, when you talk about, and I want to get after the break, we'll talk about how healthy they are, but you really do put a premium on this new collective bargaining on the rookies, on the rookie contracts. That's why you really need to see those guys play well, and if they play well, they're going to say, you're starting because we're going to put our money somewhere else.
Right, and there's leverage on the player side as well, because you're a year closer to being able to renegotiate, and trust me, I've seen this firsthand, the agents are vouching even harder. So there's enough leverage there for the players to produce, even though they're being put on the field for what they would call minimum value, but what, you, I, and people walking around outside the window right here would call a lot of money.
Yeah. Frank Thurber, he writes for Forbes Sports Money. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about where the Bears are at when it comes to salary cap. I'm fascinated by this because it's not just the Bears. I want to talk about, other areas too. I mean, we were talking about college football, Pat Fitzgerald and the coaches, Brian Kelly and Notre Dame, like they all got big contracts too, right? And those expire at some point. So it's just sort of like a status quo of contracts in Chicago sports here.
Also, they expire and they can also be bought out by a lot of wealthy and hungry boosters at their respective schools. So
that's a whole different game.
It's a whole different game.
Good.
That's right.
More to come. Contracts in Chicago sports when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight, Frank Thurber. We're talking a little sports, business of sports, contracts. Of course, Frank works for Forbes Sports Money. All right, let's talk about the Chicago Bears overall, because I remember the only time I remember cap space is when Lovie Smith was here and Jerry Angelo would sign up all those defensive players. You'd have everybody like strung out on 7-year deals, which is probably before the collective bargaining. How does Ryan Pace's Chicago Bears play out? I mean, are they in a good cap situation looking to next year?
Yeah, they are. And the bright side to that even is they could even improve that situation they're in. Alshon Jeffery is a guy to me that I don't see the Bears letting go. Now, whether they are able to reach a deal before the start of the league year, the first week of March, or if they allow him to test the waters in free agency, he's a guy that they need a big
wide receiver, right?
Right. Well, the thing is they could put themselves potentially in a pretty advantageous spot, assuming that Kevin White comes back healthy or comes in healthy. He hasn't taken a snap yet. And B, lives up to the hype that, you know, you would hope and assume a first-round pick would. Both guys are north of 6'3", 215 each. And by that, you have guys that you can put on opposite sides of the field as threats to stretch a defense vertically.
Yeah,
not many teams have that.
Yeah, right.
You know, you think of not a Calvin Johnson in the skill set sense, but in the physique sense. Two of those, not many NFL teams have that. You know, you think of a Mike Evans times two, guys that you can isolate on each side of the quarterback. You know, and Alshon's cap number is just north of nine this year. You know, what kind of money does he and his agent, Eugene Parker, Relativity Sports, ask for? Who knows? Probably top receiver money, just because that's the name of the game and the game of, you know, NFL negotiation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's a guy that they can probably afford to retain. And, you know, there's a really real value-adding spot to having him and Kevin White if he can come back healthy,
right,
and plays like you would hope a first-round pick would down the road.
On who else is expiring on the Bears? Like
Shea McClellan, Vladimir Dukas are two names that come to mind. You know, Vladimir Dukas, he's a journeyman in the sense of the way that he plays.
Right guard?
Correct.
Or, yeah.
Guard. Shea McClellan, you know, Dukas really hasn't bounced around like a journeyman would, but he's not a franchise guard, if you will, not any franchise offensive lineman. He's not a Marshall Yanda or a Ben Grubbs or a Joe Thomas, anything like that. But Shea McClellan is a guy that, you know, if I were you or WGN in here right now were to throw money, he's a guy that I would vouch for betting on that they let him go. He's a funny situation, funny circumstance.
He's played three different jobs in five different years.
And part of that you have to attribute, though, to the change in the scheme, which is probably why a big part of the reason why you saw John Bostic and Jared Allen shown the door a quarter of the way, if that, through the season. You know, McClellan came in 6'3", 260. That's prototypical size for a 3-4 outside linebacker. They came in and asked him to play 7-tech pass rush in a 4-3. And then now, three years later, he's playing inside linebacker and shed 15 pounds. That's a question mark. So if you bring him back, it's not going to be for, you know, franchise money at the position. It's more of a, you know, maybe you could call it a stopgap, you know, if you were to get him for, you know, a good value in the front office's minds. But, you know, he's been injured. You know, he's been injured in prior years as well, not only this year, but you know, he's a guy that was viewed as out of position and kind of a question mark when
Justin
Phil Emery drafted
him. Justin Kaufman, general manager, school of general managers. Yeah, he can go. He's gone. All right. They're done. That conversation's done. Okay. So the conversation I had with my brother, on Sunday was, if you right now had top free agent money, what's the best bang for your buck if you're the GM for the Chicago Bears position-wise? I don't mean player-wise, but, like, because I know it costs more to get a defensive tackle than, say, a corner or the other way around. You know, there are different costs for different things. Mm-hmm. Where is a good cost value for a free agent for after the season?
Part of that depends on where they're going to place their draft priority. Now, you know, let's just theoretically say that the Bears end up making the playoffs at 9-7 or 10-6, and they do get a wild card berth. They would draft, you know, in the 15 to 20 range ish, you know, barring any trades, anything like that leading up. So, you know, part of that is, you know, how do they again, not only place their or value their draft priority, but also how they align their draft board. You know, so is there a college player that will either be draft eligible or come out early that warrants a pick? But I would say, you know, if the draft were tomorrow, they need to shore up rush linebacker and they need to shore up the defensive end, defensive tackle spot, one in the same in a 3-4 position. So it's a question of, you know, do you address that in the draft or do you address it in free agency? You can get pass rushers in free agency. Now, it's you talked about the bang for your buck. It's a hefty penny if you're going to bring a quality one in. So, like you said, that's where you might look at really trying to find a rookie there that can come in, play on a rookie contract, and provide some value at least the first 3 years, maybe more if you don't renegotiate at that three-year mark.
When you think of Ryan Pace, a young general manager, right, but he fits the mold of the new style of the NFL where the name of the game is to try and get as many rookie contracts as you possibly can. And you see this by cutting Jared Allen, by getting rid of John Bostic. It's all to load up on fourth, fifth, sixth round picks. The hope that they may strike gold and they get someone for 4 years at a minimum cost. Is that what you see from Ryan Pace? Is that what we should see from Chicago Bears fans, that the NFL may be changing and we're not going to get the high price? We're not going to get the Julius Peppers that, you know, from a couple years back, and instead we're going to get a seventh round pick from Auburn.
Right, right. Well, you know, maybe not so much Ryan Pace. Now, he did bring a very lauded, I would say, contracts executive with him from New Orleans. And you saw it worked out in New Orleans quite well. You know, they went to an NFC championship game in 06. They obviously beat Indianapolis after the 2009 season to win the Super Bowl. So the philosophy works. And, you know, the name of the game in the NFL now is you have one type of GM or the other. Type A is the Ryan Paces of the world, whereas they are film nerds, they are tape junkies, they are former players, and they have an eye like a hawk for talent on the football field. And not only that, but how it translates into the NFL. You know, talking about Pace specifically, garnering the seal of approval from Hall of Famer Bill Polian like he did coming in, that's not easy to do. So, you know, the other side of that is assembling what they call a football administration department that looks at all the contract elements. So, you know, while Ryan is watching tape in his office, the contracts department is figuring out how to make this work. So, you know, Ryan Pace says, these are the guys I want. How do we make it work, not only with rookie deals or free agent deals, veteran unrestricted deals, they call them, but also our current guys? We can restructure guys on the 53-man or the 90-man if it's the offseason right now to make room for that. So,
yeah, so fascinating.
There's a lot of ways you can go.
Frank, thanks so much for coming in to talk about these issues. We never get a chance to talk about them, and you got to come back because obviously as the season progresses and we're in the middle of it, all eyes are going to be what's happening on the field. But it is fascinating to me to watch how the different positions may play out. We're seeing the storyline of Matt Forte and Jeremy Langford kind of go. Another big storyline, Kevin White, whether or not they resign. But more importantly, as they get better, who is expendable?
Right.
And it's interesting to get that kind of vantage point.
It's hard to do. You know, to keep two guys at the receiver position like they would have to do with White and with Jeffrey. You know, that another position would feel it, you know, we can just say, whether it's Cutler, whether it's someone else, you know, they'll feel it in another spot, but that would be a good position to be in for him.
Frank Thurber, writes for Forbes Sports Money. Frank, you got to come back. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Thanks. Enjoyed it.
The download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up this week, tomorrow the Blackhawks play. So we're only on for an hour. I think we're 7 to 8 tomorrow. So we'll talk a little City Hall. Cue that up. Do an hour show. Do a tight hour. You know, it's kind of like when the band. It's like think about like when the bands do those commercial radio kind of shows at the Allstate Arena, and there's like, oh, B-Bash. There's like 30 bands, and they play like five-minute sets. That's us tomorrow. We're doing our five-minute set. But we're back on Thursday, and we're off again on Friday. I think we do like a half hour on Friday. And then next week's going to be interesting because Northwestern basketball, Blackhawks, the Thanksgiving, there's a chance we won't be on at all.
I think we'll be on at least Monday and Tuesday. I think we'll be on at some point for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, I think.
Jump change.
And then Wednesday, I think also Hawks are playing. I think they're playing Edmonton.
I'm not available. We'll see if I show up.
You don't show up for unless it's 5 hours, yeah. 4 hours.
And it's interesting because the news coming out of Paris, the suburb of Paris right now, that there's a gunfight, a possible raid, police officers may have been shot, it as a search for more suspects mm-hmm. that were involved in the Paris terrorist attack. It's once again, as Rob said, CNN is reporting, so CNN's got it. But just watching my Twitter feed, and we talked about this Friday night, just how good and bad.
Yeah.
It's amazing to watch. I'm just like, live coverage. And then you click on it, you're like, okay, that doesn't work. I don't know what's happening. And then someone else is at a comment. I feel like there's nothing to add. There's a lot of talk and nothing to add because there's nothing that they can say about the story. It reminds me a lot of the Boston bombing. Remember they chased that guy down and they did everything and then he was in a boat for 2 hours and we just had to look at the boat. That was the great media moments. Look at that boat.
He might be in there.
He may be in there. What kind of boat is it? Let's go to our boat expert.
Yeah, right.
That's what's happening. I will say this. I went to get some dinner before the show started. Let's get our boatman, Randy Boat Jackson. On. It's a schooner. Is that a boat?
I think so.
It's a classic speedboat. I went to get dinner right here on Michigan Avenue, and it was amazing how many of the buildings here are lit up. The red, white, and blue for the French flag. In support of the Paris attacks. You're just looking out the window here on Michigan Avenue, you see the Chase Bank is building downtown. You can see just kind of the reflections on it.
Yeah.
The Blue Cross Blue Shield building over here.
I was a little bit disappointed that I didn't see that on the news. I was watching the news all weekend, and they kept on showing like the Sydney Opera House and, you know, various...
They didn't show Trump Tower?
They didn't show anything.
Trump Tower,
Chicago.
Which is great. I, you know, looking at it, I was impressed. I didn't know it had this capability, but the spire, every 5 or 10 seconds, it changes color, red, white, and blue, at the top of that building. Like, it almost, like, throbs.
It also, if you get up close, it also says, Make America Great Again. Make America Great Again.
And you buy a hat. Buy a $25 hat. The one thing I will say about the Trib Tower that we're in, that all I saw was one color, red. I think it was just red at the top.
Hmm.
It's an old building. It doesn't have the capabilities that the new buildings have.
Yeah, the newfangled buildings, I don't want to do all the technology.
Right. I don't want to speak out of turn. I know this building's for sale. But I hope that the real estate agent discloses that it may not be state-of-the-art color technology at the top.
It needs upgrading.
It needs some upgrading.
You're going to have to put your own money
into solid colors.
That.
Fading in, three colors, it can't do, but solid colors it can do. My favorite is the Wrigley Building, which is still on pink. They're just not doing it.
They forgot to change.
That's
from
the breast cancer from October. They're just like, oh, you know what? We're not changing. We're sticking with it. We're doing one more month of breast cancer. That's what's happening. And the flags here at half mast, which I don't know why. I guess it's Paris.
It is.
Why? I mean, I'm not being insensitive. It's a terrible thing. And you know that, you know, we did the whole show. I'm surprised that the American flag and the Chicago flag is at half mast. The Chicago flag is at half mast for a terrorist attack in Paris.
According to halfstaff.org, which is my go-to spot for all flag related, issues. It said that the United States flag is flown at half staff until Thursday, November 19th, honoring the victims of the Paris attacks. And then they have the president's proclamation saying that as a mark of respect for the victims in Paris by the authority vested in me, I hereby order that the flag of the United States shall be flown at half staff at the White House and upon all public buildings and grounds at all military posts and naval stations and on all naval vessels of the federal government and the district and throughout the United States and its territories And
nothing about the Chicago flag?
No, it says, I also direct that the flag shall be flown at half staff for the same length of time at all United States embassies, offices,
and
facilities abroad. But,
I'm not by any means, again, you know, saying that it shouldn't. But I'm just surprised that a city flag would fly at half mast for an international terrorism tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it was a huge deal, and it's a big thing.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But there have been, you know, if you go to... I mean, this is, you see this all the time on social media. Like, if, you know, there's an attack in North Africa, or there's an attack in Beirut, there's an attack in Indonesia at the same level. Are we going half mast on a Chicago flag?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that attack in Beirut happened on Thursday, I think, or maybe Wednesday. I didn't notice.
Well, we've been trying to get the mayor in here, so maybe we get him in for this. You know. So many other things to talk to him about the budget, pensions, about violence and safety. No, we're going to have him on the download to talk about why the flag is at half mast.
There must be a reason. Maybe somebody knows.
Well, yeah, give us a call, text us, and let us know. We'll take a break, but there has to be. There you go, 847. It's probably what all these calls just popped in. I don't know. See, this is the problem. I don't know my flag etiquette. 630 and nailed it. 847, same thing. No flag can fly higher than the American flag.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Does it? I guess. I guess that's true.
As a person who, you know, was in charge of my flag at my grammar school, you know, that was, you know, I knew all the flag rules about folding it, not touching the ground, make sure it's not tattered.
Why didn't you know that? Why didn't you know that flat, you can't go half? You can't go higher than the United
States. I mean, I think I did, but it's, you know, the knowledge is lost on
see,
me.
See, it's a problem with the internet days. You went to halfstaff.org. You couldn't remember your Boy Scout training.
Yeah.
And your color guard training. Instead, you had to go to a website.
Yeah, I did not remember my training, which is it was half-assed training, I'd probably say, St. Patricia's Grammar School.
708 is rubbing it in. That it's part of the Constitution test.
I know I passed that.
I guess I didn't. I didn't know that was. That's really a question on there. At what point would half mast flag stuff is on the Constitution test? Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, all the good work we're doing today has been undone by our lack of flag knowledge.
We've had great conversations about so many different parts of Chicago, the arts and culture scene, sports, news, punditry, 4 hours, but it was all undone by the fact that we did not know that no flag shall fly higher.
I think we knew that.
The United States flag.
I think we had to be reminded of it. I think that it was taught to us at some point in which we just kind of forgot about it.
It's kind of like parallel parking or like a three-point turn.
Yeah.
I could do a three-point turn.
Yeah. Course.
Yeah. Anyway, as 630 just best, we'll end it here. Best 630 said half-assed, half-flag training, half-mass play training. So there you go. All right. Well, there we go. We learned something tonight, Pete. We learned something. I guess I was definitely schooled in the business of flags.
You weren't schooled, apparently.
I was not schooled, but man, definitely got the short end of the stick here, man. The WGN listeners are letting me have it, saying I should have my passport taken away, so I don't understand flag etiquette. Half. This is my favorite one, just back at everybody, from 414, who's on my side. 414 said half mast is for boats, half staff is for land. So all those people said half mast, jerk. They were wrong.
Huh.
It's half staff. Although I'm taking that person's word for it. I realize.
Makes sense.
It does. And I thank everybody for sending me all the stuff on flags. I had no idea there was such a fervor for flag etiquette here at WGN. And I got it now. And Pete, and I don't want to speak for you, but I know that what I'm doing tonight, I'm going to hit the books, learn a little bit more about when... You know, we fly our flags.
There's a picture on the internet. So, what's your social media platform?
Hey, did you hear? No,
hey,
what
did,
is it?
Hey, did you hear?
No, it's You know what I heard?
You know what I heard?
Yeah, that's my new social media platform if you didn't catch the beginning of the show. No Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Mine that I'm creating right now with the tech community here is, you know what I heard?
I don't know. I can't verify if this is real, and I don't really care if it's real or not, but it was just a funny photograph, and it was like a gymnasium, like a high school gymnasium with people, the brown, you know, like little bleachers and like a sparse crowd at a high school gymnasium. And in the back row was a guy standing up, and all the people were facing him. And then like on the bottom, like it said, you know, the description of the photo was like, you know, there was no flag in the gym, so they were all like, they are all staring at the guy on the back end of the bleachers because he was wearing American flag like sweatpants.
Oh, okay. All right, you heard that on, you know what I heard?
Yeah, I saw that on, you know what I heard. I don't know the veracity.
We're on to something with that. Our new social media platform. I liked it. We got to come up with buttons and retweets and all that kind of stuff. It's at the really early phases of development. You know what I heard. That's what we're going to talk. All right. Well, it's time again for giant balloons, marching bands, floats, celebrities, and more. All at Chicago's Parade, the McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade on November 26th. I'm very excited about this. I go to the parade every single year. The parade marches down State Street between Congress and Randolph. Watch from the street, buy an individual sponsorship at chicagofestivals.org to watch the parade from the VIP stands in the TV zone or to see it live on WGN TV from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Get more details online at wgnradio.com/events. Brought to you by McDonald's, owner operators of Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana, and sponsored by Cricket Wireless, something to smile about. I love that. And, you know, one of the things that I've always loved about that parade, and if you come to the parade with me this time, Pete, is the marching bands. And it's funny because you'll get a really, like, I don't know where they get them. And we should have the parade organizer on. Because there'll always be, like, one rando from, like, Nevada. Yeah, it's like how it works. Like, to be like, oh, these guys flew in from Ohio. And they do that, you know. And you're just like, I don't know. It's just great that they're here.
Yeah.
I don't know what the deal is, but because I would much rather see Chicago schools, right? Yeah, they have them too. But,
yeah, they do. They probably have to fill out the parade.
But they got enough, because I feel like they'll always have one suburban, one city, maybe two city or two suburban, and then, you know, from Tallahassee, Florida. You're like, I don't get why they're, and there's got to be a reason, because you, and then, you know, like, and they're here for some, they signed up. I don't know if they pay in or what the deal is.
Yeah, I'm sure they, you know, the Chicago Parade takes, you know, like the auditions or you mm-hmm. submissions, and because, you know, you watch the New York Parade and there's, you know, bands millions, from all over the world.
Well, that makes sense, right? It's Macy's Day Parade, and you're like, but in Chicago, I'm like, I don't know if it really matters if there's one band from, you know, from, I don't know, from Oklahoma.
If you were in Oklahoma in a band and somebody, your band director said, hey, we're going to go to Chicago to play the Macy's Parade, right. Sign me up.
Like, we need to get ready with our we're not going to do celebration. I know we practiced that, but it's Chicago. It's a big time. Can we do that? No, we can't do that. If I do like Anita Baker or something.
Oh, nice. A little smooth.
It's got to be faster. Or I do whatever's hot, like a Bieber song.
Hotline Bling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Pete, that's a great idea. I'd
go with Uptown Funk.
You would.
Yeah.
You know that's going to be the hot stuff. Rob's on it. It's going to be overkill. Every band's going to do that song.
No, I can't help it. I like it.
I like it, too. Yeah. I like it, too. But you know the band's going to be like, and it'll be off just a little bit because they hadn't had a lot of time to work on it. No, they just taped it off the radio.